The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly you lose your motivation to get out of bed. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the season or time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round.
Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Deconstructed these walls and I found out.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. We're back. I am your host, John Williamson, and welcome to Season 12. We've been off the air, so to speak, for a little while, but I've been very busy cooking up some brand new interviews that we'll be releasing in the coming weeks, as well as a brand new limited series. So, special series that I've been working on, I'll have more information on as we get a little closer to release. But it's something that definitely falls within the realm of what we talk about here on The Deconstructionist. But it's a little different, or different enough in format, that I think that it deserves its own space. And so it'll be its own limited series podcast with its own name and site. But I'll also likely release it here as well. And hopefully you guys enjoy it. So as always, if you've enjoyed the music that you hear on the podcast, the intro and the outro, it's from our good friend, the talented Clay Kirchenbauer, who releases his music under the name Forest Clay. You can find these songs and others anywhere you find your music. This week's guest is Dr. Benjamin Laird, who just released a new book called Creating the Canon, Composition, Controversy, and the Authority of the New Testament. Always a fascinating topic we get into. Who actually wrote the different books of the New Testament, who were the original audience, and how did these various writings eventually come together into one bound volume that we now call the New Testament and the Bible. Dr. Laird received his PhD from the University of Aberdeen in my other favorite country, Scotland, and is the Associate Professor of Biblical Studies at the John W. Rawlings School of Divinity at Liberty University. He's written a number of books on the New Testament, including 40 questions about the Apostle Paul and 5 views on the New Testament canon. So without further ado, here is Benjamin freaking Laird.
I won't do it anymore. It's taking me too long to recover.
All right. Welcome to the podcast. Very excited today to have on Dr. Benjamin Laird. Thank you so much for spending some of your morning with me.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. So before we jump into it, because I think listeners are going to be very interested, I know this is a topic that has popped up over the years that folks have wanted to discuss. Before we jump into it, though, tell folks a little bit about yourself and part of your background.
Yeah, glad to. I am a Colorado native, lived there till I was about 15, and then my family moved to Central Virginia back in the mid-90s, and went to high school there to be close to my mother's family. That's why we came to Virginia. And quickly, in my college years, I had an interest in biblical studies. So I did a biblical studies degree and also took a lot of history courses. And I think the Lord just directed me to the study of the early church over time. And so I was able to, in my graduate studies and doctoral work, do quite a bit of work on the New Testament canon, which is the subject of this book that we're discussing today. But as far as, you know, my education goes, I went to Liberty University, met my wife there, did some graduate work at Southeastern Seminary, completed a couple degrees there, then went over to the UK and studied at the Universities of St. Andrews and Aberdeen, and then came back to Virginia after that was completed. And I'm fortunate to teach at the School of Divinity at Liberty University, where I did my undergraduate degree. So I've been teaching there since 2014. So I'm in the kind of the beginning stages of my 10th year there, and I get a chance to teach a lot of Greek and New Testament courses, and been blessed with a wide range of students that are undergraduate. Also, I'm able to teach a lot of graduate and doctoral courses too. So I definitely have some unique opportunities there. And one of the things I'd love to discuss is the canon. But it's not exclusively, you know, what I teach. I teach a lot of, as I said, Greek courses, and I'll teach some intro to New Testament, things like that. So really in a good situation there, and the Lord's been good.
That's excellent. And as a person with Scottish heritage, I thought that was pretty cool that you were over in at the University of Aberdeen and over in Scotland. So very cool.
Yeah, the history there is just fascinating, right? So if you get a chance to ever go, any of your listeners ever get a chance to go and just take in the history, it's something you won't forget. It's a great experience.
Oh, it's a beautiful country. Beautiful. So talking about your book that, entire conversations be based on creating the canon, composition, controversy, and the authority of the New Testament. This is something that comes up a lot, for those that have even, passively looked into the Bible, you find out that there are a lot of other writings that circulated around for a while. And so the question becomes, how did it come to be that we have this defined set of writings that became the New Testament? So what inspired you to jump in and try to answer that question, so to speak?
Well, like I said, it's been a question that I've been interested in for a long time, right? The issue of canon formation and how the New Testament came together. I mean, as a student, I was just thinking, if I'm going to invest my life in teaching and preaching, and I'm going to base my theological convictions on, what is in this Bible here, I want to know something about where it came from. And, so I thought about that for a while. I'm like most people. I hear a lot of secondhand things. I hear some viewpoints that are probably have more merit than others. But for a while, I just kind of, did the best I could to navigate that issue. Then after several years, I said, I want to look at this a little more formally and look at this in a more direct way. So I read a lot of the secondary literature, a lot of works on canon that were out there. Then also started to look into the church fathers a little bit more as my study kind of progressed there. But really, I think the subject was really prompted by just a concern about the authority of Scripture. Also, I'm just naturally curious about historical things. So, I mean, how could you not be interested, I would say, in how this unique collection of writings came together? 27 volumes that are, incredibly foundational and influential in church history and even world history. And it's just interesting that we have all these works that come from different authors written in different places and different times, yet they all came together, right, into one collection. So I've always just been curious about the process. And so really in my graduate years, in master's level courses, I started to really focus a bit more on that question directly. And it's been something I've been, you could say, dabbling in or at times very much into that question there, how the canon came together.
I think one of the things that would be a good place to start too is just kind of talking about some of the misconceptions that a lot of mm-hmm. people have. I think the average individual probably thinks, a lot of times it almost seems anyway, like people think that the book came fully formed and fell from the sky and was written by singular individuals and things of that nature. So not quite that easy, as I got through your book, and some of the things I had read previously, it's not quite so simple as that. And so talk about some of the misconceptions that you had to wade through in order to start to even break down how this came to be.
Yeah, I think the first part of what you said is very important. Sometimes we think of, or oftentimes we think of the New Testament as a book, right? It's a single book, and we kind of treat the different writings in there as though they're kind of like chapters or something. But we have this idea of this singular volume, this single volume. But in reality, what we have are individual writings that were written individually and circulated individually and came together really in different ways at different times even. So there's a very interesting history about every writing. So you have a history about the collection as a whole, but you also have the history of the individual writings in the first place. But I think a lot of times people are, like you said, they have this idea that the New Testament just kind of came in one lump sum in one instance and just kind of, fell out of the sky or something. And there it is. All of a sudden it's in the bookstore, a New Testament, right? But in reality, we have individual writings. And it was a long process. I think it was a natural process, but it was a long process that led to finally a more or less universal consensus there's never been a full universal consensus, but a wide consensus on the canon. It took a while for that to emerge. So that's one kind of misperception I think people have. then there's also a lot of theories about what prompted it, right? So even if we can come to the conclusion and we recognize that we do have individual writings and this is a long process, even if we recognize that, there's the question of what prompted this. And I think that's where there's a lot of misperceptions out there. And a lot of this is debatable. Scholars even continue to debate. So it's not as though scholars all have their one view and, you know, the lay people have their other. Even among scholars, there's questions as to what would have prompted this. What led the church to recognize these particular works? And one of the common, I think, ideas is that there was something extrinsic. There was something external, and maybe some kind of, usually it's portrayed as some kind of controversy or trial or some situation that led the church to kind of form around these, to recognize this particular group of writings. So among scholars, they might say, well, in the second century, you have this heretic named Marcion, and he was a great threat to the church, and talk about him a little bit. But Marcion had this very, very negative view on the God of the Old Testament and believed that this was a God of evil and wrath and judgment. He's very vindictive, and you want to stay away from him, right? But Jesus is, you know, he's kind of the go-between. He stands between us and this God of wrath and that's described in the Old Testament. And we don't even want to confuse the Father of Jesus with the God of the Old Testament either. I mean, that's how skewed his doctrine was. But he's known for recognizing a small body of works, and it's usually identified as a edited volume of Luke's gospel, and then a smaller, well, somewhat smaller collection of Paul's writings. Usually it's identified as 10 works. And so the idea of many scholars is that the kind of authoritative figures of the greater church saw this as a problem. I mean, you can't have a heretic like Marcion decide what everybody's going to be reading and what everybody recognizes as authoritative. So he's recognizing a version of the Gospels that resembles Luke. And so they said, you know, if that's the case, we need to actually broaden this because there's other Gospels that we view authoritative as well, you know, Matthew and Mark and John in particular. So they recognize the four Gospels and a larger body of Paul's works and some other epistles and Acts and Revelation. So it was kind of like a reaction to Marcion, where they realized, wait a minute, the church isn't recognizing enough scripture. We need to actually recognize all these writings so that these writings don't get neglected. So sometimes Marcion gets a lot of credit for the production of the New Testament, or at least prompting it. And then others would have a viewpoint. This is more common among lay people, but it's not exclusively something for lay people. Even some scholars hold this view. And that's the view that in the fourth century or so, you have different councils of the church that are very important and very influential. And so the church was kind of fighting over all these doctrinal issues. They had many disputes, especially about Christology. You know, is this Jesus, is he of divine origin? Is he to be considered one in the same nature as God the Father? Or is he a lesser created being? So they're in this quagmire. And so they had to resolve this. And the only way to resolve this would be to kind of select certain writings that should be considered authoritative, because you're not going to win a theological argument or settle a theological argument if you've got this guy over here recognizing these gospels, another guy recognizing another set of gospels. You need to be able to work. You need to at least have a foundational, you know, starting place, and then you can actually discuss what those writings present about Jesus. So the argument is that the canon that we have today is largely a byproduct of those councils. And oftentimes it's stated that maybe the Council of Nicaea, first half of the fourth century, was instrumental there. But I would say that's a misperception just because we have, well, two reasons. One is we have a lot of evidence before the fourth century that the church had gravitated towards these apostolic writings. So it's not as though we have all of a sudden the fourth century, they get this list and they say, okay, now we got to read these things. And, you know, no previous acceptance of those writings before that. So historically, it doesn't make sense, but also just the records of these councils, we don't have any firm evidence that they got together to kind of settle the issue of canon. There are a few times where the councils will actually list writings that should be read in public, but that seems to be more of just a reflection of what the church as a whole already believed at that point, rather than, you know, something novel that you know, they had just started and you know, some kind of decree that they just kind of created at that moment then. But I would say those are some of the kind of common viewpoints that people have is there was some kind of external threat. So again, that could be some kind of heresy like Marcion, or maybe even the Arian controversy in the 4th century. But that's just a common perception that everything was just kind of in limbo and people are reading whatever. And then all of a sudden, certain events just led the church to determine a certain set of writings that were to be considered authoritative. So that is troubling, I would say, for a lot of people, because now you don't really have something that is intrinsic or valuable, something about the writings themselves that sets them apart. You have decrees by fallible humans, right, that are stating which writings we should read and which we should not. And if that's really the case, then it leads to the question, did they get it right? Why did they say these writings are actually more authoritative, and why did they leave these writings out, and did they kick writings out, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of questions that we have when we make this a very, very much a human product, right? That was kind of the creation of all the whims of these councils or certain theologians or bishops of the early church.
Yeah, that becomes very interesting because, especially from the vantage point of someone who lives in the United States and in this day and age, there's a lot of emphasis placed on the authority of Scripture by a lot of Western churches, and so as soon as that question sort of arises, then it sort of throws everything on its head a little. But based on what you just said, it sounds like the reality of it is probably a culmination of things that happened over hundreds and hundreds of years. And it wasn't just one point in time where it was suddenly decided that, hey, these are the writings that we are going to view with more authority than some of these others, like, some of the other gospels that are floating around out there and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a natural process, but it's a long process. So what I argue for in the book is that we don't have just, one particular occasion where there's a decree and everybody was happy with a new list that was just kind of formed out of thin air. But there was a natural process, and this involved a recognition of the works that could actually be traced back, I would say, indirectly to Christ, which sounds really strange because we know he didn't write anything. So we don't have any works of Christ out there, but the early church recognized that each of the writings that were recognized as authoritative, these canonical writings, they have an indirect route back to Jesus. And the reason why is because Jesus, before he ascends, he commissioned, well, even at the beginning of his ministry, he commissioned several as his disciples. Later, he refers to them as apostles. John tells us, the Gospel of John, Jesus says, I have sent you out. I am now sending you out. Just as the Father sent me, I am now sending you out. So, a lot of that sent language in the Gospels. So he sends out these apostles, and they served as his representatives. So they instructed the people, they guided the church. We have the Great Commission, Matthew 28, right? Teach them all things that I've commanded you. And the apostles played a leading role in that, of course. And so they went out teaching, bearing ministry to, or witness to the miracle of the resurrection and the things they observed in life of Jesus. And then they communicated both orally and through written text. And so what we have in the New Testament then is arguably it's the extant record of the apostolic testimony. It's the testimony that the apostles delivered in that first generation there of the church back in the first century. So what we could argue is that when we read the New Testament, we're reading the apostolic testimony about Christ. So we're reading the works that could actually be traced back to those who were commissioned directly by Christ himself. So that's why they actually go back to Jesus, if you think about it that way. And then by nature, of course, conversely, the other writings, if they cannot be traced back to an apostle, then that means the chain that goes back to Jesus is broken, because they're going to be produced by individuals who are not connected to Christ then. So the early church was very much concerned that these writings were apostolic. And, what we mean by apostolic is a whole other, kind of subject here, a complicated thing that we had to discuss as well. But the early church was convinced, at least, I could put it this way, that each of the writings could be traced back to an apostolic community, which would include people like Paul and the 12, and even those who worked directly with the 12. So we have this apostolic community then that actually inherited the teachings of Jesus and passed them on and was authoritative because of their relationship to Jesus himself. So that's really kind of a key thing. But the question then of canon, which writings are in and out, that's really a question of which ones can actually have a rightful place, actually can rightfully claim to go back to Jesus. right? That is, which of these writings are actually part of the apostolic community? So if a writing was considered to be, say, a work of the second century, even though it might bear apostolic tradition, and maybe it's even consistent with apostolic teaching, the early church would not recognize it as ultimately authoritative because it was not actually produced from those individuals whom Christ sent out. So it's, as I said, it's a natural process, but it took a bit of time for them to come to a more or less a consensus on, you know, which of those writings had a rightful place. Because there's going to be question about, you know, well, what about 2 Peter? Does this actually go back to Peter? And what's, you know, who authored this? So there were a lot of questions about authorship. And that shouldn't surprise us, because if you're going to put a great emphasis on apostolic authority, you want to know who the, you know, which of the works could actually be ascribed to the apostles, which are actually authentic. So if there was any question about a particular work, it usually was around that issue. And so it was understood that the apostolic writings are ancient. They're going to go back to the first century. It was understood that they are going to contain content that was consistent with Jesus and the apostles, right? So if you have a writing that is produced in second century, by nature, they're going to rule that out. Or if it was a writing that had maybe a Christology that was inconsistent with what's in the four gospels, they would immediately, you know, not recognize that work. It's not going to be accepted widely as scripture, maybe in some quarters, but not widely. So there were many different kind of issues they discussed, but really what they were concerned about was establishing those apostolic writings that were to serve as the foundation for the church.
Yeah, I think you touched on a couple really important things there. The first one being, you know, from a historical perspective, obviously, you know, you're looking for as many firsthand accounts as possible, you know, instead of like second and third person. You want something that is, you know, based on firsthand accounts. Like, so who were the witnesses who were alive, who actually, you know, preached and traveled with Jesus? And then the second piece of that is, you know, anytime you're looking at it, a situation where you're, you know, investigating, say even a you know, a car accident, you're gathering witnesses together, and the ones whose accounts sort of like coincide with the other, you know, you're keeping those. And the one person that's like a UFO came down out of nowhere, you're like, nah, maybe not that one, you know? So you're sort of like looking for accounts that sort of match, and including those, because you can kind of be semi, you know, sure that those were the folks who in fact witnessed what happened.
Yeah. So each of the four gospels, for example, it does exactly what you're describing there. They're all written by either apostles or close associates of apostles. So Matthew and John, they're of the 12. They were eyewitnesses of these events. So their works are going to be incredibly valuable. And the early church placed a great emphasis on these writings. Matthew and John were the two most popular writings, two most popular gospels in the early church. And but then you have Mark. And Mark is simply, according to the many early church sources, he's simply bearing the testimony of Peter. So it's based on the eyewitness testimony of Peter then. And then Luke is drawing upon a number of eyewitnesses as well. We even have eyewitness language in the prologue, Luke 1:1-4. So these are not traditions that just kind of pass down from generation to generation, but they go back to early eyewitnesses, all four gospels. So that's powerful historical evidence. But then also, when you, like you're describing there, if you have more than one eyewitness, that's going to be very powerful, right? So any lawyer would tell you they'd rather have, you know, three or four witnesses than one, right? And it's, and also what's helpful too is the story, just thinking about our understanding of Jesus, it's much more difficult to, I would say, twist four stories around than one, right? So if you hear just one account about Jesus, maybe one teaching or one miracle, it's in one gospel, you're much more likely to confuse what's actually stated there than if you could, say, draw from three or four. So the more sources we have, the better picture we have of the whole story. And so the four together, they're like four portraits of Jesus, and together they give us a very good picture of his life and ministry and teaching and that type of thing. So yeah, four is important, not just historically, but even as far as our ability to interpret and understand. It's very important that way.
Yeah, and I definitely want to jump into the Gospels. I think that's a really interesting portion, you know, to talk about. But before we do that, one of the things that's kind of interesting is, you know, this idea that there are no original copies left. Mm-hmm. And so we have copies of copies, essentially, you know, because these are writings that were written down on papyrus, and we know papyrus doesn't last very long. But we have found some pretty old copies, you know, through the Dead Sea Scrolls and Nag Hammadi and some of these other findings, that these discoveries. What do those discoveries sort of tell us about the early church and sort of, you know, the formation of some of these writings?
Well, it is interesting. It does tell me a lot of things. One that comes immediately to my mind is just how popular how popular the canonical writings happen to be, right? So if you compare, and a lot of people do this, right? Especially apologetic works love to bring this up. They'll state, and it's usually for a different reason, right? They'll say, well, you know, the Gospels, we have X number of manuscripts in these centuries. And for all these other works of antiquity, we have only, you know, three or something like that. And what I find interesting about that is not so much what it tells us. And I do think it tells us something about the reliability of the transmission. I think there's some relevance there. But even beyond that, I think that it's interesting because it tells us what the early church was reading. So if it was the case that, say, in the fourth century, a council determined out of thin air the canon that we have today and said, okay, we're going to start reading these 27 works. And everybody just kind of reacted to that. And that's what we have today. If that was the case, then how do we explain the fact that we do actually have quite a few extant manuscripts from, say, even a few from the second century, but several from the third, fourth, and fifth century, much more so than any other early Christian writing? So if it was the case that we had, for example, a certain gospel that was kicked out, you know, in the fourth century, well, what we'd expect is maybe to find some older copies of that, and then maybe a decrease in, you know, those copies once you get to the fourth or fifth century. But you would expect to find more kind of copies of those works, but you really don't find that. So the 27 books that we have are by far, they were from the testimony we have, the witnesses that have survived, they are clearly the most popular writings in the early church, all 27 of them. So we don't have anything that even competes to, say, the writings of Paul or Acts, or especially the Gospels. The Gospels were the most widely read of all the Christian writings. So it does tell me that they're reading them very, very often. It also tells me that the writings were not just for scholars. And so what's interesting is a lot of these manuscripts, a lot of them seem to have been written by professional scribes, but not all of them. Some of them were just kind of, you can tell, were written by amateurs who just wanted, you know, people just wanted copies for themselves. And so we actually have a very diverse group of Greek writings that have survived to us. Some are very professional. You can tell the script is just very carefully done and just looks very nice and neat, unlike when I write by hand. But you find that very much in a lot of these early writings. But then you find, you know, there's people in churches who just want to copy for themselves. And so they're just going to, you know, copy something by hand and go with it. So it shows us that these Christian writings were read throughout the Mediterranean world. They weren't just read in, say, one community somewhere, like the Gnostic Gospels. They are read from west to east and read early on, read frequently, and read by people of all different walks of life. So sometimes we look at these early manuscripts and we're just interested in textual issues, right? The transmission of the text, and that's incredibly valuable. But it also tells me that these are very popular works early on. So I think that's another insight we can gain from that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And one of the other things that I thought was interesting too, and I'd heard a couple of these, not even really theories, but I mean, we know this is fact now, the fact that there were a lot of people in that era who were writing under the authority of someone who was, you know, more well-known, whether that be Paul or someone else, but it was, you know, not Paul, but someone writing under the name of Paul to use sort of Paul's, you know, position and authority. And this was something that was pretty common at the time. This happened quite a bit. So how much more difficult did that make it to sort of trace it, you know, its lineage back to, you know, the apostles or someone who did have actual authority? Like what was that like for the, you know, the early church? And we're talking like third, fourth century, when we're really sort of trying to narrow down which books should be included and which one shouldn't.
Yeah, good question. And that actually is a subject that emphasizes just how important apostolic authority was, right? So not all of these early Christian works that were, I would say, post-New Testament era, right? These non-canonical works, not all of them were named after apostles. We do have a few that were not. For example, there's Epistle of Barnabas and some others that are, and many gospels that are named after other figures who were not part of the 12, but a large number of them are actually named after apostles. And so that just shows how much value they placed on apostolic authority, how much of a leading role these individuals played. And there's, for example, many, many writings that are named after Peter. Peter was kind of the favorite, right? So if you're going to write something and assign it to an apostle, you know, maybe in the second or third century, Peter was kind of your go-to person, right? But there were others as well. So that does tell us that the apostles' writings were very influential, viewed as authoritative, that it wasn't just, you know, if you can just create something with great content, it's going to be accepted. It was much more than that. There had to be apostolic roots, or there had to be an apostolic origin for it to be accepted. Then as far as the reception goes, we actually don't have too much, I would say, controversy about any of those works that are outside the canon. So if you go outside of them, you'll have certain communities that might read a certain work. There might be a degree of acceptance in certain places, but you never have a work that is widely regarded as scripture and authoritative or canonical. You never find that. Again, it's just kind of pockets and waves where you'll find different Christians accept them. So you'll never have, for example, you know, the early church, you go to church in Spain or Italy or Syria or Egypt, wherever it is, and you'll go to church and they're all reading the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Thomas. It doesn't work that way. The four were recognized very early on, and there was a consensus on that. So outside of scripture, I should say outside the canon, there are some Christians who are reading these works that are circulating them, but they never had the degree of influence or popularity, never circulated as widely. So there's not as much debate about those. A lot of the debate actually centered on the disputed books in the canon. So works especially that are part of the Catholic epistles, the seven writings from James through Jude. So you'll have disputes about some of the Johannine epistles, for example, you know, 2nd and 3rd John, or some might dispute James or 2nd Peter. And there's questions then about, you know, did Peter actually write 2nd Peter, or, you know, is this a different author? And there were some disputes, even Hebrews. There's questions about who wrote Hebrews. But the church as a whole came to the consensus that these do have a rightful place in the canon, not despite their inauthenticity, but on the resolution that they actually, on the conviction that they do, in fact, go back to the apostles. Scholars might dispute that today, but that was the early viewpoint of the church. A large segment of the Christian world did, in fact, believe that they have a rightful place, that they were written by apostles, either directly or you could even say indirectly, but there's a connection there to the apostolic community for sure that the early church recognized. So I would say actually it might be as a surprise to some, but a good amount of the dispute actually centered on the apostolic writings that we have in the New Testament, those canonical works.
As our buildings become the foundation we lay, no church, tell me what made us think that we could keep us. Church, what have we done? No church. When will we ever see? Until we're all treated the same, that nobody is actually free. Started to pave the way.
guess they're not enough. Oh, church, what have we done? But there is hope, somewhere to go, someone to feed, someone to lead, someone to clothe. And who are we if not redeemed? Bringers of
prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
I've been able to live my normal lifestyle, and I've lost 20 pounds already. It changed my life.
I wasn't expecting it to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.